Welcome to the University of California San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Pandya, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdown discussing hot topics in sports medicine and society. We hope you enjoy our podcast and look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Welcome to this week's podcast, 6 to 8 weeks. We are very excited to have two guests with us, along with Drew Lansdown. The first is Dr. Gilak, who is the Mildred Simon Research Professor of Orthopedic Surgery. Dr. Gilak is a world-renowned researcher in arthritis and cartilage regeneration. And Dr. Collins is one of Dr. Gilak's postdocs and is just finishing up her training and has become a young pioneering researcher in her own right, looking at how different organ systems interact that influence the development and progression of arthritis. So welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to chat about how we're going to cure arthritis.
Awesome. So my first question, this is more of a congratulations for Dr. Gilak. You were recently inducted into the National Academy of Engineers. So prior to Elon Musk taking over Twitter, we found out through Twitter and Dr. Collins's account that you got this major award. What does this achievement mean to you and orthopedic surgery and regenerative medicine?
Well, it means that I might actually meet Elon Musk because he was inducted at the same time. So at the ceremony, I might get a chance to ask him to support orthopedic research, which is one of my main goals. But seriously, this is one of probably the highest honor I've ever received in my professional career and is sort of a game changer. So the National Academies, don't know how many people know the history behind them, but they were actually established under a congressional act of incorporation by President Lincoln in 1863. And it started off as the National Academy of Sciences and then went and spun off the National Academy of Engineering and what used to be the Institute of Medicine, which is now the National Academy of Medicine. And it's basically the role of the National Academies are to, whenever called upon by any department or agency of the government, to investigate, examine, experiment, and report on any subject of science or art. So the role of the National Academies is really to advise the government, and in this case, on any engineering-related issues. So there are numerous committees in the National Academies, and of course, for us, the ones that are going to be of the most interest are the ones related to health. And there's so many engineering issues related to health and biology right now in terms of data management, simple things like supply chains for vaccines. That's a lot of that is actually engineering and energy, pretty much anything related to engineering and the government. It's the role of the National Academies to advise to it. So for me, being able to be in that position is really an honor. And one of my main goals and interests are in STEM education, which is another major priority for the National Academies. And as we've all heard, the US is really falling behind from where we used to be in educating our youth to stay in science and engineering careers. And there are lots of reasons for that, but being able to be on the side of that where we can influence policy and direction is really a priority and an honor for me to be able to be part of that.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. I was looking at some of the other people that were in the different academies, and it really is a who's who of science and medicine and technology. But from an orthopedic and mentorship standpoint, I can't think of a better person to have been inducted into it. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So you get to bring all your friends and Twitter followers on with you, though. It's kind of like an automatic introduction to the government. We all get to, I used to say storm the Capitol, but that's the wrong phrasing now.
Don't say that. Yes. Yes, I hope to bring along everyone virtually in this process and keep people informed on what the National Academy of Engineering is doing. But of course, it's going to take some time, and I've already been volunteered for some committees, which I'm diving into, and very few things that I'd rather be doing right now, other than to get heavily involved and have some influence if I can.
And that's so exciting, and congratulations on that, and look forward to seeing your advancement in that. And Dr. Gielak, what do you think has been the biggest change or advance in science in the last 20 years?
In science? So, you know, we go through these revolutions, right? It's like Kuhn wrote about scientific revolutions, and basically things kind of putter along, and then there's some change or breakthrough that shifts us to another level. And I really think, you know, the last 20 years have been the era of biology, much of it brought about by engineering. And, you know, the techniques that we use so often now and take for granted, like RNA sequencing and the ability to engineer cells and CRISPR and so on. I mean, that's just revolutionized biology in the last really 10 years. But to make sequencing machines, that's heavy duty engineering, to be able to build systems that can, you know, on that level, be able to take out DNA, sequence it, give you the results, store data like the single cell sequencing that we often do now. You do one study and you generate a terabyte of data. And that's about, you know, a few hundred thousand times more data in one experiment than I generated in my entire PhD thesis. So I think for this period, we are still in the age of biology, and how it's going to affect all different aspects of science is just filtering into other areas.
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting to just see, even in the last 5 years, the transformation of people using PCR and dabbling in single cell RNA data and transcriptomics too. That's almost the baseline when we go to conferences. And Dr. Collins, I know I don't want to say you've been around for a while, but certainly if you've done undergraduate, PhD program, postdocs, what has been the biggest change for you in the last 5 to 7 years? What's really changed as you've evolved from student to postdoc to transitioning into your own independent research?
I think kind of echoing what Dr. Gielak said, I think just the tools that we have and what we can use, and the fact that we can be trained in one area and be able to readily incorporate new evolving technology into our questions. I think when I first got involved in doing research as a young PhD student in undergrad, we were very reductionist by necessity because those were the tools that we had. And now with the advent of so many different systems that we can use, like using CRISPR, like Dr. Gielak said, to engineer cells that then we can give them different factors that make them have different cell types, and we can study how different mechanisms, for example, may cause downstream things that we're interested in. I mean, there's just so many more opportunities to merge tools and also ideas from different disciplines to look at our questions in a different way. And I think for that reason, it's a really exciting time to do biology, because we can learn from our colleagues in cancer, for example, in neuroscience, and apply what they're doing to our questions. So that's kind of the big thing that's changed, is this really inherent kind of reliance on interdisciplinary, not only work, but also reading and being able to learn from other areas.
Great. And then maybe a question for both of you, and maybe start with Dr. Collins this time, but what do you see going forward in the next like 10, 15 years? Like, what do you think is going to be that next big leap that's really going to push us forwards?
Well, I'll be a little bit provocative, because the title of our podcast was How We're Not Going to Cure Arthritis. So I'm going to try to make an argument for how we are. And the reason for that is that even though I'm newer in this game, there's a few stories that really stick out and have kind of framed the way that I've thought about osteoarthritis, particularly, which is the disease that we study in the lab. So my mom is a rheumatoid arthritis patient, and she, at a very young age, was told that she'd be wheelchair bound by 40. And she was lucky to be involved in an early distribution of biologic drugs, or drugs that a lot of rheumatoid arthritis patients take, and those are mostly through injection, for example, the continuous protein therapy. And it really totally changed the game for her. She never had any issues with mobility. Her disease was totally managed, although, of course, there were bumps in the road. But she remembered someone telling her when she was in the 80s that, you know, it's so much better to have osteoarthritis because we can deal with that. We can give people a new joint. And now it's so interesting, because when we think about the success stories in arthritis, oftentimes people will talk about biologic drugs, because just huge success as far as treating a lot of people. There's issues and there's people that they don't work for, but clearly there are people who this has totally changed their life. And so if we're thinking about a difference from the 80s to now, obviously it's, you asked me about 15 years, so I'm cheating a bit and projecting maybe a little bit further out. But I think there's no reason why we can't apply some of these tools that we're developing to really kind of focus on coming up with a good biologic drug for osteoarthritis. And what can we learn from the successes in rheumatoid arthritis and other diseases where systemic drugs have worked really well, like HIV, for example, and other things that we've made just tremendous improvements in a relatively short amount of scientific time. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to integrate these different technologies in a way where we can really start to learn more about the diseases and treat them better.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it's amazing the progress that's been made in the rheumatoid arena, especially. And I hope that we see that same direction. And Dr. Gilak, what are your thoughts on, you know, that kind of next big development and where we're headed?
Well, I certainly agree with everything Dr. Collins said, and I would add also from a selfish standpoint of the things that we work on is that it's time for the field of regenerative medicine to actually hit its stride and get some products to market. And, you know, we've watched enough new fields develop, and almost any field that we look at in the past that was a bit of a breakthrough, like antibodies and antibody therapies, as you just described, or gene therapy. There's the initial rise, the excitement, then you find out it's actually a lot harder than it looks, and then you have the pitfalls and you back up, and then eventually things work. And we're at that phase now where, you know, the field of regenerative medicine has been around for a long time. It's probably been called, you know, named tissue engineering starting in the late 80s, but it's starting to mature now. And part of it is the amount of information we have on the disease processes that we're trying to treat is orders of magnitude more than we had 30 years ago. That it's sort of like you look at the pictures of early blood transfusions, and if you've seen any of the old black and white pictures, there's basically a bucket of blood with a tube going into it. It's out open in the air. They're saying, why are our patients getting infections? We don't understand. And I think we've been at that stage in regenerative medicine for a while. We're like, hey, we put this in the joint and it fell apart. We don't understand. And now we're starting to understand why things have failed. And a lot of it has to do with the disease process. You're trying to treat a diseased or inflamed joint and you're not taking care of that, or it's malaligned. You're making something that works really well in a normal, healthy, young animal, and then you're putting it in a old diseased animal or person and it doesn't work then. So I think as we understand those questions, dig a layer deeper, we are really poised to have a true revolution in regeneration and regenerative medicine, and get a lot of these products actually that are both medically effective but also cost effective. And we all know that you could have the best product, but if nobody's paying for it, nobody's going to get it.
Yeah, I think you touched on that beautifully. Arthritis, we tend to try to simplify things for patients and for orthopedic surgeons in particular, that we say, well, loss of cartilage is the development of arthritis. But realistically, it's much more complicated than that. And I guess my question is, we saw, like when I started training in orthopedics in the mid-2000s, all our in-service questions were about the management of end-stage rheumatoid arthritis with surgical care. There aren't even questions on the orthopedic boards anymore about rheumatoid arthritis because it's medically managed. How close do you think we actually are to having some sort of biologic or pharmacologic agent that at least slows down the progression of arthritis? And the second question for that would be, do you think it's going to be a biologic, a drug therapy, or is it going to be something that we haven't really thought of yet? Dr. Collins, I'll put you on the spot.
Well, I think that, I mean, the answer could be all of the above. I think that the kind of opportunities to deliver drugs are changing, and people are creating new ways that we can deliver some of the same targets. So I guess it's kind of a two-pronged question or opportunity, really. Is it that we don't have the right targets, or is it that we don't have the right way to give targets that we already think will work? And I think it's probably a little bit of both. So one thing we've been working on in the lab that Dr. Gilak has pioneered, and many students and postdocs have worked on this in the lab, is this idea that we can rewire cells. So we can take cells and all of the wonderful things that they've evolved to do, and we can leverage that, but make one small change, almost like a copy paste on Microsoft Word, if you will, using CRISPR, which we mentioned before, CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing. And we can instead put in a component that we want, like a biologic that's already available. And then the drug will be delivered in a sense and response manner that's really well controlled. And that's something that is only starting to be developed, but could really change the efficacy. We saw in our mouse study that we did, that we delivered a drug that's already used for rheumatoid arthritis. And when we compared the two head to head, our cell-based delivery was actually more efficacious for that application. And that really, I think, kind of told us maybe there's other ways we can think about doing this. So that's really exciting. But I also think what really excites me and Dr. Gilak is that by having these great relationships with clinicians and getting human tissue and looking at these kind of components and relationships, we can start to better understand the patient population, which I think is another part that we really have to look at carefully. We're now, just like you said, we're appreciating that osteoarthritis isn't just the damage of cartilage or loss of cartilage, and that there's a lot of other things going on with these patients that might serve as clues for us to not only leverage for therapy, but that therapy could also potentially be beneficial for other things going on with these patients. So I think it's really exciting to think about all of those opportunities.
So Dr. Gilak, I've got a question related to that. Do you think, and one of the things I think is really interesting in the rheumatoid literature is that we have somewhat tailored medications, but it's not all that personalized, but not everybody's rheumatoid arthritis is going to have the same treatment strategy. Do you think this is with osteoarthritis, do you see it as different subphenotypes that people are going to have a personalized medicine approach to this? And you can imagine a scenario where somebody comes in and then they have a targeted gene therapy with this CRISPR technology to really have a personalized approach? Or do you think this is going to be more of a, we're just going to try five different approaches and that combination is going to work?
That's really a great question. And I mean, our thought really after working on this for many, many years is, and then I think sort of getting at the root of your question, is why don't we have a cure or a treatment for osteoarthritis yet, is that I don't believe it's one disease. It has a very similar endpoint, but there's so many pathways to get there. And there are still colleagues of ours who would disagree with us, and we could have debates about this, but it's really hard to believe that the osteoarthritis that occurs following an ACL or meniscal injury is the same osteoarthritis that occurs in a obese postmenopausal woman, is the same osteoarthritis that occurs with a family that has a mutation in collagen 2 in their cartilage, or at least the pathway to go from normal cartilage to a totally destroyed joint is not going to be the same. So we need to define these pathomechanisms. So the phenotype might be the same. They all have painful joints, they have swelling, but how you get there and the molecular events or the mechanical events that take you from point A to point B are really different. And that implies that the therapies are going to be different and they do need to be tailored. Does it need to be personal, like a, you know, custom cut implant that exactly fits your joint? Probably not, but there's going to be categories. It's almost off the shelf. And sort of the way you're describing rheumatoid arthritis treatment, it's kind of the same. There are probably multiple forms of autoimmune disease that look like rheumatoid arthritis, but some are TNF dependent, some are B cell dependent, some are IL-1 dependent. And the way that rheumatologists have to treat that is try step-by-step different drugs until something works. This is why we need good biomarkers and biomarkers of disease state. We don't have these for osteoarthritis, whether they're imaging biomarkers or soluble biomarkers. And we could say, oh, these are the pathways. This is the disease stage. This is a progressor or non-progressor. Then we can potentially develop new treatments. But we've had several clinical trials for very promising osteoarthritis drugs, disease-modifying OA drugs or DMODs, and they've all failed, because basically they've lumped every possible form of osteoarthritis together and the noise in the signal is so high that you can't show any effect. When you go back, like the FGF18 trial, spirafinamine, if you start to categorize the patients by different subgroups, then you actually start to see separation of structure and pain effects. They weren't powered enough. So now that we know this, and the big drug companies know this, I think there's just going to be very different types of clinical trials and how they're organized and how they're run to be able to stratify for specific disease processes and then be able to address them individually, as you're describing. What's the personalized treatment and how personalized does it need to be?
Great. And Dr. Collins, another, I think, interesting area of research and one that you focused on some is the idea of crosstalk. Can you describe like what exactly that means and you know, why that's like a relevant concept?
So we've focused a lot on cartilage. I'm using the royal we here when we're studying osteoarthritis, but we're now appreciating that, you know, there's a lot of other tissues involved and these tissues are really dynamic. And so if you think about the joint, like a thermostat, or like there's some homeostasis mechanism that's trying to be maintained, there's all these different tissues and cell types that are contributing to that. And so this is really dynamic and is probably changing all the time. And there's probably a lot of efforts going on to keep that homeostasis. And so there's a lot of focus now on tuning into that conversation between cell types and tissues, both within the joint, but also really excitingly beyond the joint. And so there's obviously not just knee joints running around. There's lots of other tissues and a whole person attached to it. And that person feels pain differently and eats different foods. And some days has crazy workouts and other days watches Netflix for 10 hours. And all these things are affecting what the loading in the joint and what the biologic environment is in the joint. And further to that, how those two concepts converge. And so I think now we're trying to listen into all these different conversations. And one that we're really excited about is how adipose tissue or fat might be talking to the joint. And we've been using some different models to try to understand that. But what's really interesting about fat is that you'd be really hard pressed to find any textbook, anatomical text or any kind of guide that would show you anything about adipose tissue unless it's a structural adipose, like beneath the patella, for example. But when you look at an old school Netter's beautiful text, you're not seeing visceral adipose really, or subcutaneous. And so I think now that we understand that this fat tissue has a lot of biologic behavior that's also dynamic and can lead to inflammation, can give us these factors that ultimately signal to our brain that we're full, we're starting to really look carefully at these signals and figure out what we can learn from them and how they might be contributing to tissue destruction. And so there's a lot of energy from a lot of investigators in our community to try to see if this is the way that we figure out what the right mechanism is or what the right mediator might be to drug.
I mean, this might be an unfair question to ask both of you, but do you think the answer in the terms of these pharmacologic treatment strategies or biologic treatment strategies are gonna come from something that affects inside the joint, inside the nervous system, inside fat or muscle or within bone? Or do you think it's going to be a combination of multiple different targets within inside and outside of the joint in order to treat arthritis?
Dr. Collins, would you like to take that?
Maybe this is how we learn about these different subgroups. Maybe these subgroups are defined by what target individuals need. And I think that that's where we can turn to different model systems or different systems in a dish to try to get a better understanding of these signals that I was talking about. But I think it's definitely going to be complex. I think there's a reason why we haven't figured this out yet. And so I think that we have tools now where we can look at more complex changes. For example, we can use changes in cells that we were talking about before. We can add one thing and subtract another thing in the same circuit and see what the implications of that are. So I guess the answer is we don't know. And all of those options are potentially in play, in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And it goes back to our previous question that those are probably different forms or different pathogenesis of osteoarthritis. And once we know which one it is, then the target's different. So there'll be forms of our osteoarthritis where the target is fat, and other ones where the target is pain and nerve, and other ones where the target might be collagen degradation. But we need to know that before we treat haphazardly all of them the same.
Yeah, I think one of the really fascinating things for us as clinicians is the difference in phenotype of how people present to us with arthritis. Some people have almost no pain and their joint is completely and totally destroyed. They're still running 3 to 4 miles a day. And you wonder how can they do that versus other people who have really little joint destruction, but have a lot of swelling, a lot of pain and can barely move. And I really think the more I listen to you all talk, the more I think like, well, we really do have to treat those patients totally independently, not just in the end stage management, in behavioral modifications, physical modifications, and what surgeries they may or may not benefit from, but probably way upstream in not only how we look at their underlying disease process, but which pathways and where in the body we treat in order to get more effective treatment options. And if not cures, at least delaying the onset of needing joint replacement. I have one final question, which I think is may also be a little bit tough to answer, but I still think it's worth asking. Dr. Collins, what do you, are you going to become the next GILAC and lead the next generation of young scientists into the future, have a giant lab? What is that your career aspiration? Awesome.
That's the best answer.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I feel really fortunate to work with Dr. Gilak. He's a fantastic mentor. There's a reason why he's so renowned for everything he does, both within the scientific dimension as well as in kind of the personal dimension, and him helping us kind of navigate all of this as far as our careers are concerned. But I think that this is a really exciting time to be doing this work. And if patients are listening and they're thinking, wow, this is, you know, disappointing, they're really telling us we don't know anything. I mean, maybe that's true, but I think that what's exciting about that is that we can hopefully make a big impact by doing pretty straightforward things. And I think that's really exciting as a junior investigator, because when you're looking to make a drug where the option is nothing, then it's easy to make progress. So I think the future is bright. I think there's a lot of really talented cohort of young investigators that are all very like-minded and have similar goals, and really great leadership from our professional society, the Orthopedic Research Society, that is helping us all think along these lines and challenging us to really make a change. And so I think that it's exciting. So hopefully I'll be able to contribute to this area.
Yeah, we look forward to continued great things from Dr. Gilak, and we look forward to watching your career very closely as you get started, Dr. Collins. So thank you so much for taking the time. That was really informative. I'm excited to get back in the lab later this afternoon and convince the group to start looking outside muscle and other fat sources. So thank you very much and have a great day.
Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.